Yes. Sometimes you have to hold it down, sometimes you just have to tap it. Okay, so this is Bio 241, and it's March 23rd. We have two lectures before spring break. Okay, and we're going to start endocrinology chapter. I don't know if it's going to take three lectures to get through endocrinology. Probably not. So we might get done with endocrinology this week before spring break. And on the next test, I want to have chapters 9, 10, and 11. 9, 10, and 11. But you might notice on your schedule that we're not scheduled to have the next test until April 15th, which is way too late. All right, so I think I might move it up a little bit. Yeah, I might move the test up. Because that gives you 2.5 weeks, and we're going to be maybe done with endocrinology this week. Okay, so I'm thinking about moving it up. I'll let you know on Wednesday if I'm going to move it up. Not this week. Maybe I'll have it on the 13th instead of the 15th. Okay, you could let me know. I can't really discuss it right now. That makes a little bit more sense. Okay, so that does that answer your question a little bit? Yeah, okay. Okay. So, 9, 10, and 11 will be on the next test. 9, 10, and 11. And we're going to start 11 today. All right, and so we're going to be talking about some signaling molecules, namely hormones, today. Any other questions? Any other questions? No other questions? Yes. You want to know about test 4. I'm going to get test 3 out of the way first, okay? And then I can contemplate test 4. Okay, but I can't think about endocrinology and what's going to be on test 4 all at the same time. All right, so what's an endocrine gland? Let's define some of these things. Let's go back to anatomy. Yo! Okay, listen up. What's an endocrine gland? Somebody tell me a definition of an endocrine gland. As opposed to? An exocrine gland. Right, so an exocrine gland has ducts. An exocrine gland produces a product by some kind of exocytosis, and that product goes into a duct, and the duct carries it to where it's going to have its action in the body. Right, that's an exocrine gland. That's not what we're talking about today. Today we're going to talk about an endocrine gland. And an endocrine gland secretes a product that we call a hormone. And that hormone gets transported, not by a duct, but by the circulatory system. So the hormone enters the circulatory system, and then where does it go? Everywhere in the body, that's right. Now, can a hormone have an effect everywhere in the body? It cannot, right? And the reason is that a cell has to have a receptor for that particular hormone in order to respond to it, right? So that's another important criteria. And how does a hormone get into the blood? How can a hormone leave the blood? Capillary, that's right. Always try to go back to your anatomy. Remember, capillaries are the thinnest blood vessels. That's the only place where exchange can take place. Because veins, venules, arteries, and arterioles are way too thick to allow material to move in and out of the blood. Okay? Alright, so a hormone is a chemical that gets secreted by an endocrine gland that gets transported by the blood to a distant target and where it binds to a receptor to elicit a specific response. That's really what the definition of a hormone is. It's got to elicit a specific response. And it produces a specific response because it binds to a receptor someplace. All right. So another good question would be, when I say target, I'm going to talk about what? A target tissue. It's going to be a target tissue. And what makes a tissue a target tissue for a particular hormone? It's got to have a receptor to that particular hormone. That's right. Okay. So that's the endocrine system. So endocrine glands are ductless glands that secrete hormones into the blood, specifically through capillaries. All right, hormones go to a target tissue or target cells that contain receptors, receptor proteins for it. And neurohormones, on the other hand, are secreted into the blood by specialized neurons. And we already know a good example of that. Who can give me an example of a neurohormone? Norepinephrine, and what is going to be secreting norepinephrine? Where does it go if it's a neurohormone? It's going to go in the blood, What organ secretes norepinephrine? Yeah, the adrenal medulla gland, and we'll probably revisit that one today. All right, so hormones affect metabolism of target tissues or target cells if they have that particular protein receptor. All right, so here is a list of various hormones that we're going to be talking about. I don't know if we're going to have a chance to look at all of these, but you might want to circle the ones that we do talk about, all right, and become familiar with them throughout the class. But one thing I might point out on this slide right here, we see a couple hormones that are paired together, like insulin and glucagon right here. All right, why do you think these are paired together? Okay, they're both from the pancreas, but we're going to see that the effects of insulin and glucagon are antagonistic to each other. And is that a good thing or a bad thing? Yeah, that's a really, really good thing. We're going to see a number of hormones that have antagonistic effects. For instance, parathyroid hormone right here, and calcitonin. But I don't see calcitonin on the list. It's in this, buried in this list someplace. Okay, so there are a number of hormones that have antagonistic effects. All right, so let's classify some hormones that's going to influence what kind of activity they have in the body depending on what class they belong to. All right, some are amine hormones. They're derived from tyrosine or tryptophan. Right, that includes norepinephrine, epinephrine, thyroxine, and melatonin. Right, so in order to have these hormones in your body, what do you have to have in your diet? Yeah, you have to have essential amino acids, namely tyrosine and tryptophan. You cannot make those amino acids. And the easiest place to get these amino acids is in an animal protein, not a plant protein. Unless you combine plants in just the right way, you'll be missing some of these amino acids. And if that's the case, then you'll be missing some of these neurotransmitters and these hormones, which will, right, destroy your homeostasis. That's problematic. A number of hormones are polypeptide or larger protein hormones. They're chains of amino acids. These include antidiuretic hormone. What's the effect of antidiuretic hormone? Maybe you have never heard of that. But you've heard of a diuretic. What does a diuretic do? Makes you pee, makes you eliminate water. Antidiuretic hormones make you the opposite, makes you retain water, right? So we're going to see that that's antagonistic to some other hormones so that you have proper water balance. Growth hormone is another example. Insulin, oxytocin, glucagon. Adrenal corticotropic hormone. This is a hormone that stimulates the adrenal cortex. And parathyroid hormone. These are all protein hormones. Then we have some protein hormones that are modified by adding a sugar molecule to it. We call those glycoproteins. These include luteinizing hormone, follicle stimulating hormone. These help regulate reproductive cycles and reproductivity in people, and thyroid stimulating hormone. And then there's another class that are steroids, right? And steroids are what kind of compounds? Of the four main classes that biological compounds that we look at. What are the four main classes of biological compounds that we learned way back when? We got lipids, we got carbohydrates, proteins, nucleic acids, right? And so steroids are lipids, and you should probably remember what kind of lipid those are. They're all based on cholesterol, and can you kind of picture what cholesterol looked like? Kind of looked like that stairway. All right, and these include testosterone, estrogen, progesterone, which help regulate reproduction, but others that don't regulate reproduction have other functions in the body, like cortisol, for instance. All right, these are steroid hormones. And what can you tell me about these steroid hormones right here in terms of their basic physical chemistry? What kind of environment do they like? Yeah, they are not water soluble, so they like to be in lipid, they like to be in oil, right? So that means that their action is going to be totally different compared to some of these other hormones, like amine hormones and glycoprotein hormones, right, that are hydrophilic. So we'll talk about that. All right, so let's look at that cholesterol. That's the precursor molecule to a number of important hormones. All right, so here is that cholesterol. You had to memorize the structure for the first test. That can be modified, all right, by taking this hydrocarbon chain off and just putting a methyl group on there to get to pregnenolone, and then pregnenolone gets converted into progesterone. Did we mention progesterone yet in here? Yeah, we did. Okay, so that's an important female sex steroid. And then progesterone, depending on what tissue, whether it's the adrenal cortex, right? And how do you know this is the adrenal cortex right here? I just got to make sure you guys can remember your anatomy. Because what's the cortex of an organ? Yeah, that's the superficial part of the organ. And what's the medulla? That's the deeper part of the organ, right? So the adrenal gland is pretty complex. It's got the medulla, right, which, remember, secretes epinephrine and norepinephrine. But it also has this other endocrine organ, the adrenal cortex, which can convert progesterone into cortisol. So we're going to talk about cortisol a little bit later. All right, but in reproductive structures, progesterone can be converted into male sex steroids like androstenedione, and then androstenedione gets converted into testosterone. And then finally, testosterone can be converted into estradiol. All right, so I do want you to kind of know these steps a little bit. I do want you to know, where does estradiol comes from? Where does that come from? And is that a male or female sex steroid? Yeah, it's female sex steroid, and that's necessary to maintain proper bone health as you get older, right? And that can probably explain, this little flow diagram right here probably can explain why women are a little bit more susceptible to osteoporosis compared to men. Why is that? Who could look at this little pathway right here and maybe analyze it and tell me why women might be more susceptible to osteoporosis? Okay. Well, typically, how much testosterone do women have? Not very much. And where does estrogen come from? From testosterone. And what about males? Usually, well, of course, their testosterone decreases through their life, but it never really goes away completely, so it's much easier for them to produce estradiol because they have high levels of testosterone or relatively high levels of testosterone through their whole life, right? So that's where estrogen comes from testosterone. Okay, another kind of hormone, besides the steroids, what's the physical chemistry of all these steroids right here? They are hydrophobic compounds. They're hydrophobic compounds. Here's another two that are hydrophobic. So both steroids and thyroid hormones are lipids. See these aromatic rings right here? And because they're lipids, are they blocked by the cell membrane? No, they can enter the cell directly, as opposed to the hydrophilic hormones. They can't get into the cell. So tell me something about how does a signal that's outside the cell get converted into a signal inside the cell? If you had to design a system, what have you learned? What could do that? What could do that kind of thing? What do we call that process of taking a signal outside the cell and converting it into a signal inside the cell? What do we call that? And the first word is signal. And the second word is transduction, signal transduction. All right, so what kind of systems have we learned about already that can transduce a signal from outside the cell and make it go inside the cell? Like a G-protein coupled kind of receptor, right, where you have a first messenger, second messenger system, where the first messenger binds to a receptor on the cell membrane that activates a G-protein. That G-protein then changes the metabolism inside the cell. And you've learned of two important second messengers inside the cell, calcium ions and cyclic AMP, okay, that are produced by activating those G-proteins. All right, now these steroid hormones and thyroid hormones don't have to have that kind of surface receptor because why? They don't need signal transduction. Why don't steroid hormones and thyroid hormones need signal transduction? They can just scoot right through the plasma membrane and bind to a receptor that's inside the cell. So they don't need a surface receptor. All right? And there are two major thyroid hormones. Right? This one right here, thyroxine or tetraiodothreonine, has 1, 2, 3, 4, what? What's I? Iodine groups, right? So we call this T4, and this is what we call T3 or triiodothreonine. And these aromatic rings right here make it a hydrophobic compound. So it can go through the plasma membrane and bind to receptors inside the cell. And so there's no need for signal transduction. As opposed to all of the other hormones need surface receptors on the plasma membrane. Okay. So let's talk about some common aspects of the nervous system and endocrine system. Well, both the nervous system and endocrine system use chemicals to communicate. Where does the nervous system use chemicals to communicate? I think we talked about this a lot. That was like the first half of the semester. The synapse, yeah, chemical synapse, right, where you have neurotransmitters. All right, the difference between a neurotransmitter and hormone is just in the way that they're delivered. How is a neurotransmitter delivered to a target cell? How's a neurotransmitter? Where does it have to move through? Yeah, the synaptic cleft. How does it get across the synaptic cleft? Little rowboat, or how does it move? By diffusion, right? Just by concentration gradient. So it will move down its concentration gradient, and that's fine because how large is the synaptic cleft? Is it very large, you know, like Mississippi River wide kind of thing, or what? No, it's just super microscopic. So it's a very short distance, and remember, diffusion works well over short distances, like the synaptic cleft. All right, but if a hormone or if another kind of signaling molecule has to get from the pituitary gland to a gonad, like a testes or an ovary, can it go by diffusion? No, it would take all day. Right, so how does a hormone get from the pituitary down to a gonad? That's right, the circulatory system takes it there. All right, so hormones are transported in the blood, and actually there's a more diversity of effects for hormone targets because we just have a lot more hormones than we have neurotransmitters in our nervous system. All right, and then we learned about some chemicals that can be used as hormones or neurotransmitters depending on the particular system. And which one was that in particular? And what gland was it coming from? And what part of the gland? Okay, I know, too many questions. You know, I hate that when they pull you over and number one, number two, number three, and don't answer number one until you answer number two. Okay, that is the adrenal medulla, right? And what does the adrenal medulla secrete? Norepinephrine, which gets picked up by the circulatory system and it binds to sympathetic receptors all over the body. So in that case, it's acting like a hormone, but norepinephrine typically is recognized as a neurotransmitter that just diffuses across the synapse. And you should know where all those things are because, your next test is going to cover autonomic nervous system, right? And what kind of neurons release norepinephrine? Preganglionic or postganglionic? The postganglionic cells of what nervous system? The sympathetic nervous system, right? And what are the two main classes of receptors of norepinephrine in the sympathetic nervous system? We got alpha and beta, and remember we got some subclasses, alpha 1, alpha 2, beta 1, beta 2. So for sure over spring break, you got to review that. All right, so it's kind of on the tip of your tongue. Okay, and you got to know probably the signal transduction mechanism for those. Remember some produce calcium as a second messenger? Some produce cyclic AMP as a second messenger. Can you remember which receptor type works with calcium as a second messenger? Calcium as a second messenger, is it the alpha? Okay, I remembered. It's the alpha receptors, right? And the betas work through cyclic AMP. And you got to know the name of the enzyme that converts ATP into cyclic AMP that gets activated by the G proteins once they're activated. What's that enzyme that gets activated? We're going to review that again in this chapter. That is adenylate cyclase. Adenylate cyclase converts ATP into cyclic AMP, which is a second messenger inside the cell. And then let's complete this thought. Now, the action of hormones and neurotransmitters and even second messengers should be relatively short-lived. All right, so there's got to be something that breaks neurotransmitters down. So let's pick a really common neurotransmitter, like acetylcholine. What breaks acetylcholine down? Acetylcholinesterase. Okay? And what breaks a second messenger down, like cyclic AMP? What breaks cyclic AMP down? This is important for the senses chapter as well as the nervous system chapter, the autonomic nervous system chapter, and even this endocrine chapter. There is an enzyme that breaks cyclic AMP down into just basic AMP. That is, and it's part of the visual system that you have to know. It helps regulate vision. And that is phosphodiesterase. So write that down. Make sure you know what their action is. Phosphodiesterase.
Can you say what that does one more time?
Phosphodiesterase breaks down cyclic AMP. All right, and cyclic AMP is a messenger inside the cell. And it has to be, in order to regulate how signals are delivered in the cell, it has to be broken down every once in a while. All right, and that's with phosphodiesterase. All right, so what can you tell me about target cells for both hormones and neurotransmitters? In order for them to sense a signaling molecule, they have to have a receptor for it. And remember, there's two general classes of receptors. Receptors on the plasma membrane for what kinds of signaling molecules? Hydrophilic. And then there are cytoplasmic or even nuclear receptors for what kinds of molecules? Ones that can actually go through the cell membrane. What kind of molecules can go through the cell membrane? The hydrophobic kinds of molecules, right? Because the cell membrane is a lipid. Okay. All right, and there has to be a way to rapidly inactivate both. So I could ask you, how do you inactivate acetylcholine? Acetylcholinesterase. All right, how do you inactivate norepinephrine? Monoamine oxidase. How would you inactivate cyclic AMP? Adenylate cyclase makes cyclic AMP, but how would you degrade cyclic AMP? Phosphodiesterase. Okay. So those are some important enzymes. And remember, enzymes can be activated or deactivated. Mostly, what's the easiest way that you have found in your body to activate or inactivate enzymes? By using phosphatases or kinases. What do they do? What does a kinase do? A kinase adds a phosphate to a molecule. Right? And that's going to jab the molecule, going to cause some kind of conformation change. It might activate or inactivate the active site. Or the phosphatase will take a phosphate off. Again, the protein enzyme is going to change conformation, and it might become activated or inactivated, just depending on the particular enzyme. Okay. Yeah?
Can you tell us which one breaks down norepinephrine
one time? Monoamine oxidase. That's an exam figure. That's an exam figure for autonomic nervous system. Monoamine, MAO. So if you want to potentiate the effects of norepinephrine, maybe somebody has a neuronal pathway that's a little deficient in the secretion of norepinephrine, and you want to potentiate the effects of that pathway, would you want to give them monoamine oxidase or monoamine oxidase inhibitors? Inhibitors, MAO inhibitors, for people that need a little boosting of that particular nervous system that uses norepinephrine as a neurotransmitter. Okay, so those are pretty common. All right, so hormone interactions. Right, a tissue usually responds to a number of hormones. Why is that? How can a tissue respond to a number of hormones? In order for a tissue to respond to a hormone, what does it have to have? It's got to have a receptor. So this tissue here has a number of different receptors, right? It all depends on the particular cells. So two hormones might have an effect on a particular tissue, and if those two hormones produce the same effect, what do we call that? That is synergism, right? So two hormones are synergistic if they work together to produce an effect, right? And in some cases, they produce a larger effect together than the individual effects if they were added together. Right, so if we have hormone 1, it might produce, let's say, hormone A. When it binds to receptor, it might produce a response of 1. And if we have hormone B, if it binds by itself to a target tissue, it might produce a response of 1. Right? But if they're working together, synergistically, the response is not going to be 1 plus 1. It might be something like 5 or 10. Right? So that would be an example of synergism. will have a much more potent effect when they work together. A hormone, we say a hormone has a permissive effect if it enhances the responsiveness of the target organ to a second hormone. Right? And as a matter of fact, maybe the second hormone won't even have any effect at all unless, right, it has that companion hormone along with it that produces this permissive effect. And of course, if we have two hormones and they work in opposition to each other, then they, what kind of effect do they have? Antagonistic effect, right? Okay. All right, so let's look at some actions of hormone action. And I think you're going to be able to relate this to receptors and even enzyme activity. Target cell receptors show specificity. Oh, what does that mean? Specificity. Yeah, and how do you think about that specificity? What? Okay, lock and key. So it's by the shape, right? The shape of the ligand or the signaling molecule has to match up to the shape of the receptor. All right, so it's very specific to that particular shape. Has high affinity. That means that very low concentrations of hormones can bind to those receptors. And low capacity for a hormone. Cells have very few receptors. And so they can all be bound, right? They can all be signaled with very, very low concentrations of hormones. All right, and I think we talked about this already. Lipophilic hormones are what? Hydrophobic hormones have receptor, it targets cytoplasm or maybe the nucleus because they can diffuse through the plasma membrane, right? Their target is the nucleus where they affect protein synthesis. What part of protein synthesis happens inside the nucleus? Whoa, that goes back to like second week of class or something. How many steps are there in protein synthesis? Well, I see I'm not going to get through this chapter in 2 days because it's just too much fun to talk about. All right, so how many steps are there in protein synthesis? Two. What are they called? Translation and transcription. Which one comes first? Transcription comes first, and where does it take place? Inside the nucleus. And what does transcription do? It converts information from one form to another. It converts DNA, which is the template, into RNA, right? And that's got to happen inside the nucleus because where do you have DNA? Only inside the nucleus because that's where it's protected. That's where it doesn't get destroyed. Okay, so these lipophilic hormones and even thyroxine, which we talked about because it's lipophilic as well, steroids and thyroxine, bind to receptors, right, inside the cell, and then those receptors move into the nucleus where they affect transcription. They can activate protein synthesis. When there is those hormones present, they can actually call for the production of new proteins inside the cell. And those proteins can affect the behavior of the cell. What kind of protein affects behavior, do you think? Function more than structure. Like collagen. If you think of collagen, is that a functional protein or structure? If you're going to maybe pick one. That's a structural kind of protein. All right, and what kind of protein enables things to happen that might not happen by themselves? Like an enzyme. Okay, so steroid hormones can activate the production of enzymes, which then can change metabolism inside the cell. So when that happens, we call it the genomic action. And you know what? It doesn't happen very fast, right? Because you have to translate the DNA. And then what has to happen? Too bad I recorded that. Okay. First, what happens? Transcription, right? Transcription happens first, and then what happens? The RNA has got to leave the nucleus. It's got to find what organelle? Like a ribosome, right? And then translation has to happen, and that just can't happen in just a couple seconds. It takes minutes for that system to become activated. Okay, so that takes a while to produce new proteins inside the cell. All right, receptors, on the other hand, for water-soluble hormones are on the surface of the target cell. And why is that? Because they can't get through to receptors that are located in the cytoplasm, right? And so they act through second messengers. This kind of system is relatively quick, All right, and very efficient. And there's two reasons why. This is really quick, and I mentioned it before, but I think I need to mention it a lot in class. All right, when you have a G-protein coupled receptor, which gets triggered by one messenger, all right, what kind of messenger binds to a receptor of a G-protein? That's the hint. Is it a one or two? First messenger. That's right. The first messenger outside the cell binds the receptor on the plasma membrane, and it produces a second messenger inside the cell. Now, why is that a very powerful way of signal transduction, as well as rapid, as well as fast? There's two reasons for it. One is because of amplification and cascade. I've mentioned that before, amplification and cascade. I'll pick that up in just a little bit. So I'll point that out to you again. All right, and then every once in a while we do find some steroid hormones that can bind to cell surface receptors, and those kinds of hormones their action is called the non-genomic action, right? Because they're going to bind to second messenger systems as well and not to receptors that work through transcription. All right, so those are some of the mechanisms. All right, so here's a pretty nice scheme. This might be an exam figure. I'm not too sure. It's not really all that complicated, so maybe I didn't really pick on it as an exam figure because it's pretty simple. All right, so here, what do we have on this slide right here? Well, we got some red stuff over here, I presume, right? How am I doing so far? Okay, and this red stuff is what we call blood, right? So here's some blood over here. And here's a hormone that's being transported in the blood. Does that make perfect sense? Are hormones transported in the blood? Yeah, all over the body, okay? But now this one right here is a lipophilic hormone. So how much of this hormone can you put in the blood if it's lipophilic or hydrophobic? Not very much, right? So there are special protein carriers that help solubilize this hormone because its essential nature is not to want to dissolve in blood. But you can bind it to a protein carrier. There are proteins in the blood specifically designed to carry these kinds of compounds around. And it's in a constant state of equilibrium of jumping off and jumping on, jumping off and jumping on, okay, depending on how hydrophobic or how hydrophilic it really is. All right, but because of Le Chatelier's principle, if we took all of this hormone out of the blood, what would happen? Would it be the down arrow that gets promoted or the up arrow if we took all of this unbound hormone away, according to Le Chatelier's principle? What would happen? Just think of this as a chemical reaction. And if we take all this away, which way is that going to drive this equilibrium? It's going to drive this hormone off of the protein carrier into the blood. Okay? Or if we put a lot of hormone in the blood, what's going to happen? It's going to force the binding of this free hormone to these protein carriers, right? So I tell you what, if that's not obvious, maybe you got to see me during office hours or talk to your lab instructors or something. That was a pretty important question on the last test, all right? So I think you really have to understand that, all right? And as the concentration of this hormone increases in the plasma, what's it going to do in terms of getting into the cell? Yeah, it's going to diffuse more. So again, you can use an understanding of Le Chatelier's principle to see that if the concentration of the blood increases, then the concentration in the cell increases. All right, and look what we have. And why can't it go into the cell? Because it's a hydrophobic compound, right? And here you have a nice receptor protein, binds to receptor protein in the cytosol, and then it will translocate into the nucleus where this unit right here can bind to a DNA molecule. Not the free receptor, but the receptor that's bound with the hormone is a proper signal, right, which then is going to initiate transcription of this length of DNA, right, which is going to produce a messenger RNA, and that messenger, what do we call that step? Going from DNA to messenger RNA? That's transcription. So this hormone response unit right here and this receptor protein is what? A transcription factor that initiates transcription. Then the messenger RNA enters the cytosol. Translation takes place, and that produces a response inside the cell by producing these various proteins. which changed the behavior of this cell right here, right, as a result of this hormone binding to this cytoplasmic receptor. All right, so nuclear hormone receptors serve as transcription factors when bound to a hormone, but only in that case. That activates transcription. Okay, and we're going to see that that happens in many, many circumstances. All right. So let's talk about nuclear hormone receptors, and in particular, the hormone response element. Okay, so here is the receptor protein for what kind of hormone? For a steroid hormone, which is going to be inside the cell. It's got a DNA binding domain, so here is the part of the receptor that can bind to the DNA molecule, and then here is the ligand binding domain. This is like the glove, right, that the hand has got to fit into. The hand is going to be what? H&H hormone right here. So the steroid hormone can bind to the ligand binding domain. Now this receptor protein becomes activated. It will diffuse into the nucleus, and it can actually bind to the DNA. The DNA is at the beginning of a gene, it has a hormone response element. So it has two sites. We call these half sites. And each half site can bind one receptor protein. Right? And in order for transcription to take place, both of these half sites have to have a hormone, right, with its receptor protein bind before transcription can take place. All right, so this is what we call dimerization of the hormone response element, right, which is going to initiate transcription. And in this particular case, let's just say that H right here and H right here are exactly the same hormones. And the way that we would talk about this hormone response element is that what kind of dimer is that? Would you call that a homodimer or a heterodimer? If H is the same and the receptor proteins are the same, that would be a homodimer, right? And some steroid hormones work through dimerization when these two subunits are identical. So that's a little foreshadowing because you might see some other things happening. All right, so transcription can take place after dimerization takes place on this hormone response element. And what does that stimulate? Transcription, right, which is going to produce new functional proteins or enzymes inside the cell. And if when you activate or produce new enzymes, what's going to happen to metabolism inside the cell? It's going to change, right? Because what do enzymes do? Well, let's go back. Maybe you're not thinking of what an enzyme does. What does an enzyme do? It speeds up the rate of a chemical reaction, right? So now the metabolism inside the cell gets speeded up in one direction or another, all right? As a result of having this signaling compound, this hormone right here, okay? All right, so let's talk about the mechanism of thyroid hormone action. The thyroid gland, from anatomy, can you remember where the thyroid gland is? Point to it. Yeah, it's right here. It's by your thigh, just underneath your thyroid cartilage right there. It secretes about 90% thyroxine and about 10% triiodothreonine, or T3. All right, 99% of the T4 is bound to a carrier protein in the blood. Right? Why does it have to bind to a carrier protein in the blood? Why does T4 have to bind, or T3?
Because they're
hydrophobic hormones. Right? So they have a carrier protein. It's called thyroid binding globulin, or TBG. All right, and so that's what carries T3 and T4 around in the blood. But it's in what, always a constant equilibrium from the bound form and the free form that's in the blood, but there's really not a lot of the free form in the blood. But if there is free form in the blood, what can it do? It can enter cells, right? And when it enters a cell, more T3 and T4 unbind from the thyroid binding globulin to make the concentration of the unbound form pretty constant. So this bound form is a reservoir of thyroid hormone that's being carried in the blood, right? But when T4 enters the cell, before it can have an effect, it's got to be converted into T3. One of those thyroid iodine molecules is cleaved from T4 to make a T3, and then T3 can bind to the receptor protein located inside the nucleus, right? And Then what happens inside the nucleus after it binds to the receptor protein? What's going to happen inside the nucleus? What does a hormone response element do for the nucleus? It initiates transcription, right? It starts protein synthesis. Okay. So here we have a nice diagram of how this happens. Here we have T3 binds to the receptor, okay? And this is inside the nucleus, so here we have some DNA right here. So here is triiodothreonine binding to its receptor, and it binds to a hormone, at least one half site on a hormone response element. Now it can't activate transcription unless, right, there is retinoic acid that binds to another hormone receptor that binds to the other half site. So dimerization still has to take place, right, but in order for transcription to take place, it doesn't form a homodimer. This forms a heterodimer, right? So T3 really cannot have an effect unless there are permissive levels of retinoic acid, right? So that kind of explains the permissive effect of retinoic acid on the action of triiodothreonine, right? Because this a hormone response element has how many sites? It's got two sites, right, that have to bind these particular hormone receptors. All right, and so that's going to stimulate transcription. All right, so the thyroid hormone response unit requires heterodimerization in order to stimulate a transcription. Okay, so what kinds of hormones have hormone response elements? What kinds of hormones? They're going to be the lipophilic or the hydrophobic, the kinds that can diffuse right through the plasma membrane. Okay, question? Not the hydrophilic kinds, right? So that's what I want to talk about now are the hydrophilic kinds. What's another way of saying hydrophilic? Water-soluble kinds of hormones, right? Like amine hormones, right? Glycoproteins, proteinaceous hormones. And can these get through the cell membrane? No, they can't. But how are they going to have effect inside the cell if they can't even get into the cell? What's the process that happens? It's called signal transduction. And what's your favorite way for signal transduction? G protein coupled receptors. Exactly right. Okay. G protein coupled receptors. So water soluble hormones use cell surface receptors because they cannot pass through the plasma membrane. Right? Actions are mediated by second messenger systems. So what's the first messenger? What's the first messenger going to be? It's going to be, but we're not talking neurotransmitters in this chapter necessarily. But good guess. That's where we learned it first. A hormone, right? And what kind of hormone in particular? Water-soluble hormone, because it can't get inside the cell, right? That's the first messenger, binds to a G-protein coupled receptor, which then produces a second messenger inside the cell, right? And give me a couple of your favorite second messengers. Calcium and cyclic AMP, right? Okay. All right, so hormone is the first messenger. That's the extracellular signal. The second messenger carries the signal from the receptor to the inside of the cell, where it's going to change the metabolism inside the cell one way or another. All right, so this is really close to an exam figure that you've already studied. All right, so here's a nice G-protein coupled receptor. And let's just go over it anyway. So here is the receptor protein. And what is this little dimple right here in the receptor protein? Thank you. What is this little dimple right here? You should consider that like the active site, and it's got to have the proper shape so that this ligand, which in this case is a hormone, can bind, right? And that's highly specific. The shape of the hormone has to be complementary to the shape of this active site on the receptor protein. So you could actually think of this receptor protein as being like an enzyme, right? It has many of the same kinds of properties. And what this receptor or enzyme does, it doesn't really convert the hormone into anything, but it activates right? The G proteins right here, and you see the alpha, beta, and gamma subunits, and in this particular case, the alpha subunit then will break apart, diffuse through the membrane, and bump into another protein that's in the plasma membrane, and here is adenylate cyclase. All right, and what does adenylate cyclase do? It's going to gobble up ATP and make what out of it? Cyclic AMP. So now we have high levels of cyclic AMP inside the cell. And what's a good way to think of cyclic AMP? It is what? It's a second messenger. Yeah, it's a second messenger. What's the first messenger? Yeah, Mr. Hormone right there. All right, so first messenger is hormone. Second messenger is cyclic AMP. And cyclic AMP can bind to various enzymes that are inside the cell that are already there. And in particular, right, it can bind to an inhibitory subunit on a protein kinase. Now, what does this protein kinase do? It's going to add a phosphate to an enzyme someplace, and when it adds a phosphate, it can activate the enzyme or deactivate it, so it acts like a switch for turning the enzyme on or off. All right, but when cyclic AMP binds to this inhibitory subunit, which is inhibiting the protein kinase, right, it doesn't have the right shape to bind to the protein kinase, so now it comes off. So here we have the inhibitory subunit with cyclic AMP, which is the signaling molecule now inside the cell, right? Cyclic AMP is the signaling molecule. So now this protein kinase becomes active. And so it runs around inside the cell, phosphorylating various proteins, and these other enzymes can be activated or inactivated depending on this particular system. And we'll give you a couple specific examples. All right. So why does this system right here, this adenylate cyclase, CMP, cyclic AMP system, work fast compared to the lipophilic kinds of hormones, which take at least a half hour to get going? Okay, two things, cascade and amplification. Okay, so a cascade means different levels of amplification. So where do you see amplification taking place right here? All right, I'll give you a hint. How many signaling molecules do you see? You see one, okay? But how many cyclic AMP molecules do you see? Okay, but it's not really labeled on this diagram, but tell me something about an enzyme. Does it get used up during the reaction? It just sits there and does what? Converts the reaction, allows the reaction to go over and over and over and over and over without getting used up. So once adenylate cyclase gets activated, right, it can make thousands of cyclic AMPs with this one hormone signal. Right, because adenylate cyclase doesn't get turned off immediately. So that's one first messenger producing what? Thousands and thousands of second messenger cyclic AMPs inside the cell. And we call that amplification. That's amplifying that signal. Okay? But not only that, when cyclic AMP binds to this enzyme right here, it might activate this enzyme. And does this enzyme get used up during the reaction? That produces another level of amplification. So when you have a series of levels of amplification, what do we call that mechanism? That's a cascade mechanism. So this can happen very rapidly and produce a very powerful response inside the cell because of amplification and a cascade mechanism. Okay, so does that make sense a little bit right now? Okay, I hope so. But I'll talk about it some more. All right. Yeah. 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 Okay, so once adenylate cyclase becomes activated with one hormone signal, it can produce thousands of cyclic AMPs. All right? And thousands of cyclic AMPs can produce, each one can produce thousands of protein kinase that become activated. So you have thousands upon thousands of these enzymes that are busy doing things inside the cell, right? So you have different levels of amplification. So second messenger systems are pretty powerful that way because they're rapid and they're very efficient. Okay. All right, now let's talk about reversing these effects right here. All right, and so here we have the second messenger, cyclic AMP, inside the cell. That's going to activate this protein kinase. But we want to have some control over this system, right? So we eventually want to take this cyclic AMP molecule away. What is the enzyme that breaks cyclic AMP down? Maybe, okay, so this hormone goes away. So the first messenger goes away. That should what? Decrease the levels of the second messenger inside the cell. How do you decrease the levels of cyclic AMP inside the cell when the first messenger goes away? There's an enzyme that destroys cyclic AMP. And it's pretty much always active at some level, and that is phosphodiesterase. That's always active inside the cell. All right, so here we see it on this slide right here. All right, so when the hormone disappears, then it should no longer have an effect inside the cell, which means that the second messenger should go away. And what assures that is phosphodiesterase destroys cyclic AMP. So then the system is just going to sit around and wait for the appearance of the first messenger again to become activated. All right, so this might be an exempt figure. Yeah, it is. Okay. But you're probably pretty familiar with it already. Okay, so here is another second messenger system. This is the phospholipase C second messenger system. So here is another second messenger. And actually, you're going to see a cascade of second messengers right here. So what do you see a hormone. What kind of hormone does this look like? If you're going to group it into one of two main classes. Water-soluble, right? Can't get inside the cell. So it's got to have, what, a? Not a cytoplasmic receptor, but a cell surface receptor. Here it is. And it's coupled to G protein. So this is a G protein coupled receptor for this water-soluble hormone. When it binds, it activates the G proteins. Some of these subunits wander around through the membrane instead of bumping into adenylate cyclase, which would make what? Cyclic AMP. It bumps into phospholipase C. All right, and I'm sure somebody found phospholipase A, phospholipase B, and then about the third one they found some really cool activity of phospholipase C. And what can you tell me about phospholipase? Just by nomenclature, just by looking at the name, phospholipase. It's an enzyme because of the ASE. Okay, sounds like enzyme because of ASE. And what's the substrate? Phospholipids. Oh, geez, we need phospholipids for this enzyme. Where are we going to get phospholipids for this enzyme? Are there any around? It is the substrate for this enzyme, right, is the plasma membrane itself. How handy is that? That should remind you of the water molecule. Not only is the water molecule the solvent that we're dissolved in, but what is water? It's a substrate or a reactant for many chemical reactions in your body. Like what? Give me one. Where water is a product of important chemical reactions in your body or a substrate. How about hydrolysis? Yeah. Okay. Or dehydration synthesis, right? So water molecule not only is a solvent, but it's an important participant in the reactions. The same thing for the plasma membrane. Not only is it the solvent that these proteins are dissolved in, but it is an important substrate for the reaction of phospholipase C. Okay. So not only are we made out of water, not only do we have biochemistry that takes place in water, but there is a small part of our bodies that is lipophilic or hydrophobic where these kinds of reactions take place, right? Hydrophobic reactions take place in this environment right here. So this is like a secondary solvent system that our body is made out of. So phospholipase C will work on phospholipids and it will make a couple different kinds of compounds. One is called IPE3, right? You don't have to know the formula for it's called inositol triphosphate. I just call it IPE3, right? And that can diffuse into the cell and it can bind to smooth endoplasmic reticulum. What's one of the functions of smooth? I tell you what are all the functions of smooth endoplasmic reticulum? lipid synthesis. Ooh, that's sort of interesting because we're talking about lipids right here. Lipid synthesis as well as storage for calcium. High levels of calcium can be stored in smooth endoplasmic reticulum. And when IPI3 bumps into smooth endoplasmic reticulums, that opens up calcium channels. So now calcium floods the inside of the cell. And what do you know about calcium? It can be used as a second messenger, right? And in particular, it can bind to various kinds of proteins. Did you learn a particular protein that calcium can bind to that will change metabolism inside the cell? It will modulate the activity of enzymes inside the cell. It's a protein that can bind calcium that will modulate activity inside the cell. Like, you learned that, good. It's called calmodulin, okay? Calmodulin is a particular protein that can bind calcium and then it will change metabolism inside the cell. All right, so both IPI3 and calcium are second messengers, right? And the first, due to this first messenger that is outside the cell. All right, so this is a pretty fascinating kind of mechanism because it actually uses the plasma membrane to produce the second messenger inside the cell. Okay, the other second messenger, well, I don't have a picture here to show you, is diacylglycerate. But again, that's produced from the phospholipids that actually make up the plasma membrane that are going to produce calcium inside the cell. So calcium diffuses into the cytoplasm, binds to and activates calmodulin. So calmodulin is a protein. When it's bound to calcium, activates various protein kinases, which do what? Protein kinases phosphorylate enzymes, and when an enzyme gets phosphorylated, what's it going to do? Stay the same? It's probably going to go through a conformation change, and that might enhance its activity or it might inhibit the activity of that particular enzyme. All depends on how the conformation changes. Right, and when the activity of these enzymes change, that will produce the hormone's specific effects inside the cell. All right, now you're probably really thirsty to understand a specific mechanism. Now you learned some generalities of some mechanisms. So let's relate this to a specific first messenger, second messenger, and how it has an effect on your daily life. Okay, and in particular, well, I could ask, but I'll ask, but don't say. Does anybody have diabetes mellitus in here? What would be your guess? Probably somebody does, right? Very prevalent. And what is diabetes mellitus? Inability to regulate blood glucose levels, okay? And what have you learned about regulation of blood glucose? When you're in a fasted state and you don't have glucose in your digestive tract being absorbed into the blood, how does a normal person maintain normal blood glucose levels? Where does it come from if it's not in your diet, not in your GI tract? Yeah, your liver stores glycogen, which contains, what, thousands, hundreds of thousands of subunits of glucose, and then it's broken down. Glycogen is broken down into glucose, and then the liver secretes glucose into the blood. What do we call that process of glycogen going to glucose? Ah, well, that is what? Glyco what? Glycogenolysis, right, the lysis of glycogen, right, and glucose then is secreted into the blood. All right, so you're probably really interested to know how that happens. All right, one of the hormones that helps regulate that is epinephrine. And epinephrine can work through a couple different second messenger systems because there are two different kinds of receptors in liver cells. So here we have a nice liver cell. So even though this looks red to me, that's not blood. Here's a liver cell. Okay. And what about epinephrine? Is it hydrophilic or hydrophobic? Is it a lipid compound? It is hydrophilic. It is not a steroid and it's not a thyroxine. Okay. All right. So does it have a cytoplasmic receptor or a cell surface receptor? It's got to have a cell surface receptor, right? And how many different kinds of cell surface receptors are there for this adrenergic system? Well, you got alpha and beta, right? You got the two major ones, alpha and beta. Okay, so guess what we have on this slide? Here we got alpha, and here we got a beta receptor. And, of course, these cells, the nucleus is is building these plasma membrane protein receptors and putting them in the membrane right here. All right, and so beta, how does beta work? Through a G protein coupled receptor, as well as the alpha is a G protein coupled. But what are the 2 second messengers that are operating? Calcium or cyclic AMP. The beta works through cyclic AMP and alphas work through calcium as a second messenger. All right, so let's start with over here. Let's start on the left-hand side. So we have a beta adrenergic receptor. Epinephrine binds to it. It's a what? A G protein coupled receptor. All right, and the G protein dissociates and it bumps into an enzyme in the plasma membrane. Namely, what's the enzyme? Adenylate cyclase. You see it here on this slide. Oh, is this an exam figure? Oh, I hope I made it one. Good. All right, so adenylate cyclase does what? It converts ATP into cyclic AMP. Cyclic AMP can bind to an inhibitory subunit on this enzyme right here, all right, which is a protein kinase. So when it binds to the inhibitory subunit, this protein kinase becomes active. And so this protein kinase can chop off a glucose molecule from glycogen. But what else is it doing? What does a kinase do? Adds a phosphate to it. So now what do we have? We got glucose 6-phosphate, right? Because here is a protein kinase, right? And then, glucose 1-phosphate, and that gets converted to glucose 6-phosphate, right? So this probably was on the exam last time. And how does glucose 6-phosphate get into the blood? Because there is, what's right here? What enzyme's right here? There's a phosphatase, right? Glucose 6-phosphatase that phosphorylates glucose, so now glucose can leave the cell, right, because that phosphate group is highly polar, doesn't allow glucose to leave the cell. And so now what happens to blood glucose as a result of an epinephrine signal? It increases, right? So that increases blood glucose when you're in what kind of state? A fasted state, right, through this beta adrenergic receptor, right, which works through cyclic AMP. But that's not the only system. Right, because there are alpha adrenergic receptors in liver cells. So when epinephrine binds to these G protein coupled receptors, that increases calcium. Okay, maybe working through IPE3 or DAG or various other kinds of second messengers. So this calcium can enter the cell or it can be released from smooth endoplasmic reticulum. Calcium binds to, here is that calcium binding protein, which we call calmodulin. Calmodulin can activate by deinactivating the protein kinase, right? So protein kinase becomes activated, so that increases the rate of glycogenolysis, right? So remember, these second messengers work by adjusting metabolism inside the cell by adjusting the rate of enzymes, like a protein kinase for glycogenolysis that produces glucose 1-phosphate and glucose 6-phosphate, and then you have a glucose 6-phosphatase, which then helps the secretion of glucose into the blood, helping to maintain blood glucose levels. All right, so here is a nice real-world circumstance of all those G-protein-coupled receptors and second messenger systems. So this produces a very fast response. All right, who's got a question on this slide right here? Okay, so study it a lot for Thursday and ask me some questions. Ah, yeah. Yeah. What are you looking for? I don't know. Let's talk about that. What might I be thinking of there? What's happening? That is, what's the stimulus for this cell? Ooh, sounds different when I put my arms right here. I don't know if you hear that. Let me take it away. It's much better. I hate it when I hear myself talk. Okay. We have a response loop right here. Okay. What's the stimulus for the... How does the response loop always start? With a stimulus. What's the stimulus for this system right here? Yeah, maybe a decrease in blood glucose, okay, or if you want to start with a hormone signal like epinephrine, Okay? And what's the response going to be? Increasing blood glucose. So at that arrow right there, at the end of the arrow, I might want to put like the response, which is increasing blood glucose. Or, you know, you could put blood, but I think that's too simple. Think more in terms of a response loop, right? Increasing blood glucose. And as blood glucose goes up, what would you imagine would happen to epinephrine concentrations? Would go down, right? To maintain homeostasis, to maintain glucose in the proper range to support life. Okay. What other hormones are you familiar with that help regulate blood glucose? It could be in a similar way, or it could be by increasing blood glucose, or do you know any that decrease blood glucose? So if you want to have proper concentrations, if you want to have proper concentrations in blood glucose, should you just have a hormone control system that is the accelerator? Or should you have one that's only the brake pedal? You should have one that increases blood glucose and one that decreases blood glucose that work antagonistically to each other. Okay? All right, so let's talk about some of those hormones. And maybe you've heard of insulin before. Okay, and what does insulin do? It lowers blood glucose. So we just saw epinephrine. What does epinephrine do? Raises blood glucose. Okay, what kind of condition that you might be experiencing that increase blood glucose? Okay, eating, yeah, but in terms of your, there's generally two ways that you can be existing. Okay, through your sympathetic nervous system, right? What are two ways that you can characterize the sympathetic nervous system? You got sympathetic and parasympathetic. Sympathetic is considered which kind? Fight or flight. All right, and the other is rest and repose. So when you're in the fight or flight mode, like when you're anxious, what happens to blood glucose levels? They go up because of what hormone is being released? Epinephrine from the adrenal medulla that causes increases in blood glucose. Okay, so that's just sort of interesting to think about that. See if we can tie it all together. All right, insulin does not increase blood glucose. It does what? Decreases blood glucose, right? So, and when people don't have control over their blood glucose, that we call that diabetes mellitus, and probably now you know there's a couple of different kinds, right? One kind is when somebody can no longer secrete insulin. I think we call that type 1. Okay, and then there's other kinds of diabetes where somebody might have normal levels of insulin, but still they can't regulate their blood glucose because even though the signaling molecule concentration is fine, guess what? The receptors are broken. The target tissues can't listen to the hormone signal, the insulin signal, because the receptor system is broken some way or another. So we're really interested in knowing something about the receptor system. So on this slide right here, we have the insulin receptor, a typical insulin kind of receptor. And you can see that it actually kind of reminds me of a hormone response unit because there are two of these subunits. These are locked into the plasma membrane, however, they're not in the nucleus. All right, so here is a dimer. When insulin binds to the receptor, dimerization takes place, and this protein becomes activated. And notice that this is a transmembrane protein. The receptor is on the extracellular side, and it goes all the way through the plasma membrane into the cytoplasm. And inside the cytoplasm, there are subunits right here. When insulin is bound to it, right, it becomes phosphorylated. And when it becomes phosphorylated, it can now become an active enzyme, which is going to phosphorylate tyrosine. So what do we call an enzyme that phosphorylates something? What is it? It's a kinase, right? An enzyme that phosphorylates something is a kinase, and it phosphorylates a tyrosine amino acid on various proteins that are inside the cell. So the insulin receptor is what we call a tyrosine kinase receptor. And when it phosphorylates these tyrosine amino acids in an enzyme inside the cell, that changes the activity of those enzymes inside the cell, producing what? Like a cascade of events with different levels of amplification. All right, so We have these phosphorylated chemicals inside the cell, which work through different levels of amplification and cascade to increase glucose uptake inside the cell. So let's see how that happens. All right, so on this slide, what do I really want you to know? That the insulin receptor really is an enzyme that gets activated when it binds insulin. And what kind of enzyme is it? It's a kinase. And in particular, you should know that it's a tyrosine kinase. All right, so instead of activating a G protein, right, it activates molecules by phosphorylating tyrosine amino acids in a protein someplace. All right. So let's take a look at this slide right here. All right, so here we got a cell. We see a nice plasma membrane right here. And what can you tell me about glucose? Can glucose go across the cell membrane by itself? No. Right, because of all those polar bonds with hydrogen, because glucose is a sugar, has a lot of oxygens. Oxygen has a hydrogen bound to it, and that oxygen pulls electrons away from those hydrogens, making that a very polar compound, which means that glucose loves to dissolve in water, but it can't dissolve through the plasma membrane right here because it's a lipid. All right, so glucose is trapped outside the cell. Well, let's just say that we have a high concentration of glucose outside the cell or in the blood and very low inside the cell. Which way does glucose want to move? It wants to move in, but can it? No, because it can't get through the plasma membrane. And if glucose can't get inside the cell, what's going to happen to this cell right here? What's glucose good for? Cellular respiration. What's cellular respiration good for? Yeah, ATP synthesis, right? Through all those metabolic reactions like glycolysis, Krebs cycle, right? Electron transport. So if glucose can't get into the cell, it's going to starve to death eventually, right? Okay, so there's got to be a way for glucose to enter the cell, and insulin is the passport that allows glucose to enter the cell. So let's talk about the mechanism of why insulin can work as a passport. All right, here are some vesicles inside the cell, and we see that it has some proteins within the membrane of this vesicle. And give me the names of some vesicles that you learned. What kind of vesicles might a cell have? Lysosome. What's the job of a lysosome? It digests things, right? It's the intracellular digestive system. Does that seem like something that we would want to use to make passports for glucose to enter the cell? Probably not. Okay? It's just going to break things down. Lysosome. What's another kind of vesicle? Peroxisome. What's its job? To detoxify harmful compounds inside the cell. That can't be used to make a passport to let glucose enter the cell either. And I think there was one more kind of vesicle that you had to know the function of. And it starts with an E. Because it's inside the cell, it's called an endosome. Endosome. And we said the function of an endosome is routing various membrane components around inside the cell. So it's going to have membrane components, and here we see some proteins that are in the membrane of this endosome, and these proteins right here are the GLUT4 transporter. And I think we've run into that GLUT4 transporter already. It's for facilitated diffusion of glucose. So which way can glucose go if it's diffusion? High to low. So here's a cell that's gobbling up glucose to make ATP, so there's low glucose inside the cell, high outside the cell, and glucose can enter if these GLUT4 transporters are not in the endosome but are found where? In the plasma membrane. So these GLUT4 transporters are inactive when they're in the membrane of an endosome, but they actually start to perform their function when they're inserted into the plasma membrane right here. Right, so when insulin binds to this tyrosine kinase receptor, it phosphorylates a bunch of proteins inside the cell, which then translocate this endosome to the plasma membrane. Right, and what can you tell me about the membrane of this endosome and the membrane of the cell, plasma membrane? They're basically the same, right? They can fuse together very nicely, like a couple of soap bubbles. And when they fuse together, what happens to these GLUT4 transporters? They're in the cell membrane now, and they can perform their function, right? They can allow glucose to run down its concentration gradient. So that allows for the cellular uptake of glucose from the blood via this process right here. Right, so insulin is just the first messenger outside the cell that causes the fusion of these endosomes to the plasma membrane, and then glucose can enter the cell. Always happening inside the cell is the reverse process, where the plasma membrane is kind of being gobbled up and put into vesicles inside the cell. And when that happens, that takes these GLUT4 transporters away from the cell membrane, and then the cell loses its ability to take glucose up. All right. So the only time this cell can take glucose up is when it sees this insulin signal binding to the tyrosine kinase receptor right here. So this is a pretty interesting mechanism because it's very rapid. How long would it take to build this GLUT4 transporter? It's a protein. What would have to happen if you wanted to build a GLUT4 transporter from amino acids? What would you need to do? What's the building block of a protein? Amino acids. And how do you build a protein from amino acids? How many steps? Two steps. What's the first step? Transcription inside the nucleus, and then translation in the cytoplasm. How long does that take? A while, right? So, to build all of these transporters right here, you know, it might take you a day to get sufficient levels of glucose inside the cell. It would be horrendously long. So what the cell does is that it builds thousands of these transporters. It puts them in reserve. They're in reserve where? In the endosome. And whenever glucose concentration goes up and insulin is secreted, then it takes these GLUT4 transporters that are already made, ready to go to work. All it has to do is put them in the plasma membrane, which is really rapid, and the cell can take up glucose immediately, right, without having to go through all those steps of protein synthesis. So that's a pretty handy mechanism to change metabolism inside the cell in a very rapid fashion. Okay. So make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. Next time, we're going to start with pituitary gland. But I'm sure you all have a lot of really good and important questions that we're not out of time yet. So I would like to take some questions. The GLUT4 is stored in endosomes, okay, inside the cell. Because if they're in an endosome right here, they can't be used for cellular uptake because they're trapped inside the cell. But as soon as they're inserted into the plasma membrane, they start to function perfectly. So the reservoir is that endosome. I don't know. I'll have to think about the second messenger. This is not a clear second messenger kind of system. Okay? It's a tyrosine kinase receptor enzyme. Okay? So maybe a different class. It's a different class of receptor. Okay, see you Thursday.